Nearly 100 union members and supporters marched on the lobby of U.S. Bancorp Thursday, demanding a contract that includes affordable health insurance. About 800 private security contractors are represented by Service Employees International Union Local 26, and they are in negotiations concerning a contract that expired on January 1st. The group representing the five contractors said the most recent rejected contract was the last best final best offer. However, after the sit-down strike on Thursday that resulted in 17 arrests, the companies issued a statement saying they are dedicated to working with its employees and the union to provide an affordable health plan. Then on Monday morning, a federal mediator said the companies have no plans to negotiate at this time. SEIU's members represent nearly 80% of the security guards in the Twin Cities, and the union has been authorized to call a strike if necessary. Here is today's economic report. Some good news for the economy? It depends on which side of the fence you are on, the buying or the selling side. Sales of existing homes made an unexpected increase in February, suggesting some buyers are taking advantage of the heavy price cuts happening around the country. Sales of existing homes jumped by 2.9% in February. That's the biggest increase in a year. According to the National Association of Realtors, the median existing sales price dropped to $195,900, the biggest drop in 9 years.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Everybody, and welcome to the Guy James Show. So good to know you're all out there waiting for a good show today. And of course, we'll have a good show if you participate. I always love to have your thoughts and ideas put into the show. And you can do that by giving us a call at 866-546-5254. Love to have you join the program today. That's 866-546-5254. And if you've got minutes to spare on your unlimited calling plan, you can give us a call at 941-876-6896. And don't worry about calling. Don't be nervous. Don't be shy. We won't bite your head off unless you're one of those and you're mean and nasty and got it coming, then we will. We can do that. A lot to talk about today, and here we are coming to you from the beautiful blue waters and sandy beaches of Southwest Florida, Naples, Fort Myers area, all around the country, all around the world. Welcome to everybody, our expats living overseas, our people that aren't expats that are living overseas. We're glad to have you along with us. We've got, I know for a fact, somebody listening in France right now. We've got somebody in the UK right now, and we've got somebody. What time is it in Australia right now? It seems to me it's like 3 or 4 in the morning. I don't know. Tomorrow? I get mixed up on that. But anyway, I know we got somebody. We get email before the show. I'm listening, and all that. So interesting to know where everybody's listening from. And, of course, we got people from every state and union on here right now, and that's comforting to know. A lot to talk about today. I want to talk about a couple things today. First of all, let me remind you that Paul Waldman from Media Matters is going to be on with us today. Paul and David Brock co-authored the new book called Free Ride, John McCain and the Media, and he will be with us in the second hour today. A great book, a really good read about how the press has just been hands-off to John McCain. Have you noticed that? Have they really gone after John McCain for anything? And any little thing that has come up, it's been one news cycle, and that's pretty much it. Even those big gaffes he had last week about the Shia and the Sunni and the Iranians, he didn't know who the hell was fighting who. I mean, when he went over to Iran or Iraq last year and bought the rugs in the marketplace and told everybody how hunky dory it was and what a peaceful place it was in downtown Baghdad, when he had who knows 1,000 soldiers around guarding him, snipers on the roofs and all that, hell yes, you could have been safe in downtown Berlin during the height of the Second World War. With that kind of cover around you, and he always comes home saying, oh, things are great. Things are great. Well, we're going to talk a lot about that today. We're going to talk a lot about Mr. John McCain, John Sidney McCain today, and how the press has treated him with kid gloves. What an unusual situation we have this year. We've got race entering the contest. We've got gender involved this year. And we've got a war hero in there. And make no mistake, I do feel John McCain, I'm not going to be like one of these people that swift-boated John Kerry and doubt his credentials and all because he's in the other party. Absolutely not. John McCain deserves his just dues for what he went through during the Vietnam War. Took a hell of a man to do that. Let's say that right up front, and I respect him for all that. I do. So here we've got three people, a woman, a black man, and a war hero, none of whom can really be touched about those three things. You've got to lay off those three things. You've got to lay off the race. You've got to lay off the gender, although they really haven't. And they've really laid off of John McCain because he is a war hero. So we are having candidates treating a little bit differently this time around than we normally do. And I think the operatives on all the different campaigns have had to be a little more careful this time. The opposition research people and the people that put out the talking points and the dirty little political pamphlets and phone calls and all that, they had to be a little more careful. You do not want to get caught disparaging John McCain's war record. You do not want to be caught disparaging women in Hillary's or folks of different races, as in Barack's position. So we're having a little bit different campaign this year, just a little bit different. And you know what? I think this is an interesting day for us, an interesting time for you and for me. And, you know, I've heard ad infinitum now, and I'm damn tired of it, of hearing how, oh, this race, this primary is tearing the party apart, and it's going to ruin the Democratic Party, blah, 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 blah. God, I'm getting tired of hearing that. You may disagree with me. I know many of you do. I do not think this is a bad thing. I do not think this has been a dirty campaign. I think it's been rather mild. And just because it's the Clintons in it, everybody, oh, those Clintons, they'll do anything to win. They'll do anything. Hey, they'll all do anything to win. Don't differentiate one from another. They're politicians. They want the job of the presidency of the United States. Don't kid yourself. The Clintons, Barack Obama, John McCain, they'll do what it takes to get the office. Don't just, let's say that one, you know, We're not going to pick one of them out and say, oh, well, he's Mr. Nice Guy and he's just going to play fair enough. No. No. These people have had aspirations of being the President of the United States for a long time. Each of them has harbored that in their hearts for a long, long time. Make no mistake, Barack Obama didn't decide last year or 2 years ago or even 3 years ago to run for the presidency. Neither did Hillary and neither did John McCain. They've all had that as the prize, the ultimate prize for themselves for a long time. So let's get off this stuff about, you know, cutthroat politicians. They're all cutthroat politicians. They're big-time politicians. They're running for the most powerful office on earth. Now, this is where I think things are a bit different this year. And, oh, by the way, did you see our third candidate, Mike Gravel, has abandoned the party? He has. He's abandoned the Democratic Party. Mike Gravel has now swung over to the Libertarians. Mike, we hardly knew ye. He's gone. So there you go. We're down. We actually are down to two now. And Mike Gravel, former senator from Alaska. Joined the Libertarian Party. I don't know if he's officially got his new badge or what. I don't know. But what I was getting at right now is I do think this is an important time for us, for you and for me. And I say that because I think that you and I, all the voters, I don't think we've ever had a better chance to play our hands if we're playing poker here right now. We're holding all the cards, and we don't have a big window here to wait. And here's what I'm getting at. I do believe we are holding the cards. Both of our candidates want the nomination so bad they can taste it. Neither of them have it locked up yet. And they would dearly love to have it locked up. And it looks like Obama certainly has the edge right now. But don't kid yourself that he wouldn't like to, in the next few days, just say, hey, I've got it won, and that's it. Game over. He would love for that to happen. What do I mean we're holding the cards right now? Can't we, as a group, for once in our lives, a bunch of Democrats, and I assume that I'm talking to mostly Democrats, and I know I am, can't we guarantee one of our candidates that will put them in the White House if they swear a solemn oath to us to end the war within 6 months or so? Don't we have that kind of bargaining power right now? And if we don't, when would we ever have it? Certainly not after the election is over. Certainly not. So now's the time. Now's the time to make our voices known. And these remaining primaries, those of you that live in Pennsylvania, those of you that live in North Carolina, those of you that are superdelegates, even pledged delegates that could change your mind, now's the time to let these people know, yes, I will get on your bandwagon, but Mr. or Mrs., you are going to pledge to us that we want the war ended. We are holding the cards, and you're not going to sit in that chair in the Oval Office unless you promise us. When are we ever going to have a better chance to do that than we have right now? When? I don't think ever. Once the election's over, once they take the oath of office, once they get on their merry way running the government, you know what's going to happen. Well, we can't quite pull everybody out right now. That wouldn't be prudent. We're going to have to, you know, for security's sake, we're going to have to guard the embassy. We're going to have to leave people in close proximity in Iraq in case something happens. We're going to have a base there. We're going to have to keep our people in Kuwait. We're going to have to keep an eye on the, you know, the Kurdish situation and all that. No. We don't need to be the peacekeepers of the Middle East. We do not be. When did we sign on to do that? Yes, I know. A long time ago, we signed on to try and promote peace in that area, but not down the barrel of a gun. We never signed on to do that down the barrel of a gun. So now's the time. Let your candidate know. Let's all let our candidate. Let's get the blogosphere going. Let's get everybody that's really working hard in this campaign. Let's everybody get together. Our Democratic clubs, our phone. Let's tell them. Whoever comes through with that promise of ending the war, we're with you, and we will put you in the White House. Why can't we do that? If we were Republicans, we could do that. We would all stick together long enough to do that. We would be single-minded enough to go ahead and do that. Why can't we do that as Democrats? Why can't we for once just hold together, get our coalition together on the blogs, all across the internet, all the groups of us, get together for that one thing? We know that that is the aim of the people on the left. We know that. We don't have to convince any people of that. All we have to do is convince the candidate that that's what we want. So why can't we just do a massive effort to do that? Why can't we? I don't know. I hope we can, but our window is short. We've got just a little while yet. Once we get the candidate picked, then they'll be off on their merry way. You know how they say they head to the left for the primary and then back to the center for the general election. I want that to be the focus of our candidate, first and foremost. Yes, we've got a bad economy that needs a lot of attention. Absolutely. And yes, we've got health care problems in this country that are critical, that need to be taken care of. But first and foremost, let's get this war over with, so that we as a country can sit here and be at least proud of ourselves again, that we can get our self-respect restored around the world, get out of that area, stop breeding hatred like we're doing now in the Middle East. Let's do that first. Do you see any reason why we can't? Do you see any reason why we shouldn't? We're reasonable people. This is not a nation of idiots. We have our share. But there's something that has to be done, and now is the time to do it. Most definitely now is the time to do it. We're going to have a short word from Georgie Jr. Bush here, and we'll be back in a minute or two.
And now a message from the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
Good morning. Today I put my strong support behind a legislative effort to put the guns back in our national parks. For too long, Americans have vacationed to our great national parks with their families, enjoying the beauty of nature without a firearm at their side. Once visitors to our cherished and protected forests, mountains, and streams are properly armed, they will be inspired to shoot at things. They will finally be able to stave off rabid elk, or stop a chipmunk run amok of the law. Armed park visitors will also be able to protect themselves from other park goers. No longer will families picnic in fear of another family taking their meal at knife point. With a sidearm, you can safeguard your picnic site. Perhaps most importantly, campers will be able to protect themselves against the tyranny of the park ranger who tries to get you to put out your fire. Join me in support of this common sense legislation. Thank you for listening, and God bless you.
Round up the usual suspects.
Hi, boys and girls. This is Rick Goodner, part of the Weekend Wrecking Crew. And I'm here to tell you that you cannot miss Billy Shears. The man knows his music. The man knows what you're thinking. Tune in and listen. You'll be surprised. He's going to play the very song that you were thinking that you needed to hear. Now, he's a genius. Maybe a bit psychic. I promise you. Tune in on the weekend, listen to Billy Shears Night Sounds, and you will hear the song you've been waiting to hear. And you'll enjoy your time as much as I do. Right here on the Horn Head On Radio Network. Make sure you don't miss what you've been waiting to hear with Billy Shear.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Play as time goes by.
today. How about yourself? I shouldn't be. I had one of those nights last night where I just couldn't sleep. I could almost go face back down on the desk right now. Yeah, I don't know why that happens. If I had one big wish in my life, it wouldn't be to rich or be to richer or famous or all that. I'd like to sleep a little more. That's a strange one, isn't it? Did you see that on Wall Street Week where that guy won the $85 million? He actually won a $220 million lotto. And he hired a team of accountants to help him manage his money. He's got a plan to turn it into $1 billion within 15 years, an aggressive plan. And my, what a good job he's done. We'll probably talk about that a little later on in the program. But he didn't go out and blow it all like some people do. Actually, I've seen people give up that kind of money, lose that kind of money. I don't know if that much, but you see these people winning $10, $15, $20 million and blowing it all. There was a case of it right over in Miami not too long ago. Hey, I would like your opinion. Do you think his primary is over with? Do you go along with the consensus in the mainstream media right now that Obama's got this locked up and Hillary can't win it no matter what, and the only reason that she's staying in it is for spite or to try and hope that a safe falls on Obama or something? Do you feel that way? Is it over? How do you feel about the superdelegates? How do you feel about them getting together and having this summit meeting, as they're talking about the superdelegates? I know a couple superdelegates. I don't know how they'd feel about that, actually. I really don't know. And pledge delegates. We're starting to talk about maybe pledge delegates changing the votes, because, after all, they are not absolutely committed to one or the other, from what I understand. So it can be interesting. How do you feel about it? Do you think it's a slam dunk for Obama right now? Love to hear your opinion on that. Let's head on over to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hi, Guy. This is Gene calling in Naples.
Hi, Gene. How are you?
Hi, good. Hey, I'm listening to your show, and no, I don't think this campaign's over with. This primary's over with. I wish it was, but it's not. I don't think Hillary's the kind of person that's going to let it be over. She's a pit bull, and she's going to go down fighting.
What has she got to gain by hanging in there if it appears to be inevitable?
Well, I think ultimately throwing it into a stalemate if she can. I mean, it's like anything else. A strong enough defense makes the other ones play offense, which means they're going to have to go out and recruit, I would guess, recruit these superdelegates and make them make the final decision. Plus, isn't there a couple of wild cards out there with Al Gore and John Edwards? We hadn't heard from them yet.
Do you think either of them could get the proper structure in place, the campaign structure in place? I mean, Edwards would have a better chance than Gore. Because we'd only have, just a few months there. Could Al Gore, and we've heard this, I mean, Al Gore come riding in on a big white horse and break a stalemate at the convention and ride off into the sunset, but would he have the money and the campaign structure set up to be able to do it?
Well, I don't see Al Gore as a viable primary presidential candidate, but I do see him as a key player that can cause some movement one way or another in the polls and in the voting for the superdelegates. But John Edwards, on the other hand, is someone that could become a viable candidate. I understand his campaign's just suspended. It's not over with. He could actually go to the convention and wreak havoc with the two primary candidates that we're looking at today. I think for those reasons, if Hillary was a little bit more of a passive, condescending person that could or would back away, then maybe, yeah, we could say this is over and let the popular vote take precedence. But just don't see that happening. I just don't think that she would ever allow that. That's probably a vague way to say that this thing's not over, because she won't allow it to be over. I just think that it's it's going to get to be a bloody battle. I hate to see it as a good, loyal Democrat. I mean, what is your opinion? I know where you're coming from politically. Do you see this as being a clean fight?
Yeah, I do. I'm one of these that I've been preaching on the program that I don't see why everybody's up in arms saying, "Oh my God, this is a bloody fight," and it's just the most terrible, dirty political fight we've ever seen. I don't think it's even close. I think the media has been driving it for ratings, and I understand that they love a good fight, and they use that word often. And every little thing either one of the candidates says or does, and oh my God, what a big story this is! They said this, they said that, and I just don't think it's the kind of dirty campaign that a lot of people think it is.
Well, I hope you're right. I mean, I don't know that it's necessarily a dirty campaign. I think so much of what is said is typical campaign rhetoric, but in the way it's said, it may be atypical. It may come off as a little nastier than what you would normal hear in regular campaign banter. I was discussing with an associate of mine today what kind of an impact the Iraq war is having on the election. As we look at developments there, obviously if things get worse, which they seem to be doing currently, is that going to help the Democrat Party or hurt the Democrat Party? Is it going to make McCain a more viable candidate or make him less of a viable candidate? Because he's talking about this thing going forever. If the thing escalates, will America say, okay, enough's enough, let's pull out? Or will America say, it's escalating, let's put the military man in charge of this, and because he can do a better job? What is your opinion of that? I mean, I didn't call to interview you, but I'm curious about that.
Well, I think John McCain is absolutely married to the war. He's got the ball and chain around his foot. He is married to it like no one else is married to it. He is content to carry on the Bush banner in this war. He's been behind the surge. He's been out there talking positively of how wonderful the surge has worked. And of course, we're finding out in the past few days that maybe things aren't quite like that they thought they were. And so we've got Shia on Shia violence. We've got Shia on Sunni violence. We've got the Iranians to worry about. We've got Al-Qaeda to worry about. And John McCain's mixed up in the middle of this more than anybody else. I think he has far more to lose if things go south. And I think al-Sadr and the Mahdi army and all are really throwing a monkey wrench into the works right now, and I don't know whether they're doing it for political reasons. They could well be doing it for political reasons, but I think that they're definitely throwing a wrecking ball into it right now, and if it does go south, John McCain's going to pay.
Well, how do you see the American public? Let's just a scenario. Let's say this war takes a nasty turn, like it seems to be doing the last few days. Does the American public look at that as reason to pull out or reason to reinforce and stay in?
Oh, I think it's reason to pull out. I mean, they're always going to be the hardcore hawks that are going to want to stay in. And let's face it, John McCain is as much of a war hawk person being in office since General Pickett clear back in the Civil War. So he's a hawk. He's going to want to stay in it till the last dog dies, as they say. But I don't think the American people will stand for it. I feel that. I feel that, and I hear that talking to Republicans even that were behind George Bush and voted for him twice have said, you know, enough is enough. If we were at the precipice here where we thought, well, we're just about over the top. We're just about having a victory, and you know how Americans like to win. Well, that would be different, but I don't think the public's seeing that right now, and I think what they're seeing on TV this week and the reports coming out of Basra and Kirkuk and other places in Iraq, we're certainly seeing a far different story than Petraeus was telling us just a few months ago.
Well, I think then that begs the question, then you go back to Hillary and Obama, neither of which are promising an immediate pullout of American troops and getting them out of harm's way. Edwards is the only one that did that, and I think probably Richardson did too. But Edwards' position on that becomes much more viable as this war escalates.
Well, it does. And as I mentioned earlier on in the program, aren't we the voters, isn't the constituency in the driver's seat for temporarily? We've got an opportunity here like we don't normally have. Once they get elected, they're off and running and going to do what they will and to hell with what we think. But I think right now, between Barack and Hillary, why can't we just put the heat on both of them and say, hey, look, We'll be happy to put either one of you in that'll end the promise to end this war right now. I know the economy's big on the meter right now and lots of things are, but we gotta end this war first and whichever one of you will promise will hold your hand up and swear to the Democratic constituency that you'll end this war, we'll put you in the White House. I think we have that kind of leverage right now.
I think that's a fabulous idea, a fabulous concept. How do we mobilize that action? How do we get Democrats to, in one unified voice, say to them that we are going to choose the candidate that will make that solemn promise?
Well, we need to get them all. We need to get them all mobilized. The DFA, the DLC, the MoveOn.org, all of the big blogs, the Daily Coast, the Huffington Post, everybody, the blogosphere, the internet, all the liberal media.
And all you liberal talk radio hosts. We don't have enough of them, but if you could get all your associates in the same radio field as you, Guy, to make the same appeal out there, then I think if we could speak with one voice, which is always the problem of any political party, is trying to speak with one voice. Once we can, we'll be an unstoppable force.
Well, and there's one particular party that has more trouble speaking with one voice than the other.
Absolutely, that's my party.
Yeah, mine as well. We all want to do all the talking, and we're not like Republicans where we could just sit down and come to a consensus in 5 minutes in a room of 500 people and have everybody marching in lockstep. That's just not the nature of the beast.
Well, they want to be spoon-fed, and we don't. We want to go forage for hours. It's you're right. That therein lies the difficulty. It's just that we are free thinkers, and hopefully a more creative population out there politically. And it's hard to get everybody on the same page, going the same direction at the same time. But thanks to people like you and other talk show hosts. Of course, I don't know many others other than the Guy James show, but you're making a difference, and I know I personally appreciate it.
Well, Gene, we have to face the fact that we're smarter and we're more well-versed than people that march in lockstep, and that's a little problem we have over here.
Well, I'm not going to argue with anybody that says I'm smarter. I'm
no.
going to go right along with you. I think I'm glad you recognize our intelligence.
Well, we are. There's no doubt about it. Let me put you on the spot. We're in a tough primary right now, and it's not completely been decided yet. Where are you at on this, and where do you think the Florida, you're calling from Florida,
right.
What about the Florida delegations, and where do you stand?
Well, where do I personally stand? I say with it that they leave Florida and Michigan alone, that we do not re-vote, that we made our bed and we lay in it. Florida legislature provided us this situation. I say let's don't spend the money to redo that. Leave it alone. Where would I like to see it? I'd like to have all of America vote for John Edwards and let's pull out of this war overnight. I think he's an honorable and honest man and one of the few that has not been tainted by national politics. Where would I like to see the country go? Of course, I'd like to see it go back to where it was in the 50s, the utopian society. The economy was good, everybody was working, schools were progressing, and we were at peace. How do you get there? I'm not sure, but I think our best hope is with the Democrat Party. There's no question about that, because the Republican Party that's in control now And you have to say they're in control. I know a lot of people point to the Congress and say, well, it's a control by Democrats. Well, it's not. The House of Representatives is. The Senate is not. The executive branch is not. So, no, the Democrats are not in control, but we have a chance to be there and turn this country around, and I'm going to do everything I can to see that that happens.
Well, Gene, I want to thank you very much for calling the program today. Appreciate hearing your insight and your thoughts on it. We always love to hear what good Democrats have to say and what's...
Guy, you keep up the good work. Hang in there, and all these listeners, I know you've got thousands of listeners worldwide on your show. You've been at it for years now, and you are probably the most credible spokesperson for the Democrat Party on the radio waves out there. So hang in there, and hopefully people continue to support the show and send some money in now and then so you can feed your family and your dogs. I know you got dogs.
Yep, love the puppies.
And those are big animals, too. Boy, they eat a lot, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Hang in there, guys.
Gene, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you.
You bet. Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Well, there's a good Democrat. Gentleman that I know works hard for the Democratic Party, and I have as well, and I know many of you do as well. And whether it comes to walking precincts, making phone calls, doing what needs to be done, going to be a lot of it having to be done this year. And I hope we can settle this quickly. I am not of the opinion that we're destroying the party right now over the primary, but we'll get it settled. And when we do, and I would encourage everybody not to worry about these national polls you're seeing, and I think they're all within the margin of error right now, that McCain might be slightly ahead of a Hillary campaign, or Obama might be ahead of a point or so of a McCain. These polls, in that regard, don't mean anything right now, not until we get our candidate chosen. And I will predict that the animosity and all the rancor that's come across between the Hillary campaign and the Obama campaign, that once this thing's over and everybody has a chance to cool their jets a little bit, cool down, think about it for a day or two, I think everybody will come home, join hands, get together, and defeat John McCain. That's what it's going to be all about, and I think that is exactly what will happen. And as you know, I have been supremely confident about that since day one, and I remain so. Nothing has happened to change my mind on that. So we shall see. I'm either going to look like a genius or a fool by the time this is over, and I know what I prefer. So we're going to pause for a break. 866-546-5254, and we'll be right back.
Well, I tried to make it Sunday, but I got so damn depressed. I set my sights on Monday, and I got myself undressed. I ain't ready for the altar, but I do agree there's times when a woman sure can be a friend of mine. Will I keep on thinking about you, Sister Golden Hair Surprise? And I just can't. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the show. You are listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, and we hope you'll join us here on the program today. 866-546-5254. Just had a good call from Gene. Love to hear the insight and ideas of all of you. Mine matter, yours matter, all of ours matter, and we like to hear them whether they're agreeable with what I have to say or not. We enjoy hearing them. I see the market is down 114 points right now. And let's see, where are we at with the gold today? All of you that have the big piles of gold at home, where are we? I know oil was up several bucks. You didn't think it was going to stay down, did you? Light crude's up to 107.50. Oh, went way up today, 107.50. And gold is at 954.20, so it went up a few dollars today as well. Man, oh man. I think that gold will be back at $1,000 an ounce again fairly soon. The market is so volatile right now, I don't know how the people sleep at night that are heavily involved. But then I'm not heavily involved. Are you heavily involved? I didn't think so. We've been talking a lot about the economy, and by the way, I do want to remind everybody once again, coming up at the top of the hour, right after the top of the hour, we're going to have Paul Waldman on. Paul and David Brock co-authored the new book, Free Ride, John McCain in the Media, which chronicles John McCain's absolutely free ride by the media. They've all banded together and decided to, and did you see Chris Matthews last night? You talk about pandering to a candidate. Chris Matthews just said, well, you know, John McCain's is a military hero, and that's why I love him, and that's why I think he really went on about it, and it surprised me a little bit. But I don't know if anything surprises me coming out of Chris Matthews' mouth lately. He's willing to say and do just about anything, I think. And the war. The Pentagon announced today that this eruption of violence in southern Iraq, where the Iraqi forces, backed up by our forces, were battling Shia militia, said one of the strangest things that I've heard anybody say. They said that this violence was a byproduct of the success of the surge. Now, if that isn't trying to put a make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, I don't know what is. This violence today and yesterday is a byproduct of the success of the surge. Pentagon Press Secretary Geoff Morrell said it showed that the Iraqi government and security forces were now confident enough to take the initiative against Shiite extremists in the southern port of Basra. Citizens down there have been living in a city of chaos and corruption for some time, and they and the prime minister clearly have had enough of it, he said at the Pentagon press conference. The positive outcome of the surge to stop the violence was an increase in elective violence, and let's not debate the merits here or the veracity of that claim, but let's point out that this is the worst framing of the situation in Iraq that I've ever heard. And what they're saying is the surge is so successful that we can expect a lot more violence. And that's one of the dumbest things I think I've heard him say yet. Yeah, the article I read about said the fact that they're resorting to suicide bombs is a sign of our success. It's getting ugly there. It's getting very, very ugly there once again. And I would like to know. I've been in contact with several bloggers who are there. Some people that we've had on the show, and we'll have them on the show again. People who are Iraqis, who have lived there and expatriates, and have been back to chronicle this event for us. And they haven't seen this surge as a big success. They have seen a lowering of the violence for a while, but it's going back up again. And the big question is it being done for political reasons, or is this a natural course of events? Are these people astute enough to watch the political situation in the United States and start exerting extra pressure on there right now to influence the outcome of the political events here in this country? I don't know. Or is it just a natural turn of events that the violence can't be held back anymore? Al-Sadr called the truce. Can he not hold back his people any longer? I know they're demonstrating in the streets today. It's not a pretty situation. It has the potential to completely blow up. And there, once again, will be, 170,000 of our military personnel stuck right in the middle of it. And it's not necessarily just a civil war. It's not necessarily just a sectarian thing. I think they're finally learning that lesson, that it is not necessarily sectarian, that it is Shia on Shia in some cases for political power. And to be sure, some of it, there is a little bit of al-Qaeda activity, but not nearly al-Qaeda activity that our government would have you believe. Not nearly so. They've always had to play that card in order to justify being there. And I don't think they've done a very good job of it, and I don't think they've convinced a good portion of Americans that al-Qaeda is the great big bad threat there, that the American military and advisors and so forth, the Bush and particularly Cheney, have said that it is. We've got an insurgency without question. We've got Shia on Shia violence for political power. We've got Maliki, who doesn't appear to have a good grip on things. We know their government, although they've been elected, hasn't been all that powerful, hadn't been all that successful. Haven't even seemed to want to be so far. I think everybody's been disappointed with the actions of the newly elected Iraqi government. They just haven't seemed to have the intestinal fortitude to step in. And I know it's been difficult for them. I know that some of them have been hunted down and killed and all of that. But some of them haven't had any problem, and they're just kind of sitting back and waiting to see how the chips are going to fall. And that to me, and some of the fat cats leave the country whenever they want to. I know a lot of the Iraqi parliament, legislature, people go to Paris and London and stay there until things cool off and go back. So it's not a functioning government in any way, shape, or form. We've not made the political progress that we need to make in that country. Petraeus knows that. You're starting to hear that from him, that that's what victory means there, is to put in place a solid, functioning government. And they're nowhere close to that. They're nowhere close to being in a position to be able to defend themselves. They're no place close to be able to curtail the violence that they have in the country. And we keep hearing that question asked over and over and over again. When will they be? Well, that's the $64,000 question. When will they be ready? And nobody wants to answer that question. That one is sidestepped all the time when McCain has made his comments about it. And by the way, let's hear McCain comments.
Let me ask about Iraq. You were at a town hall meeting here in Derry, New Hampshire, and here's what you...
I'm glad you've been paying attention to the town hall
meeting. I follow you closely, Senator, believe me. Here's the question and answer.
President Bush has talked about our staying in Iraq for 50 years.
Maybe 100.
We've been in South Korea. We've been in Japan for 60 years. We've been in South Korea for 50 years or so. That'd be fine with me as long as Americans are not being injured or harmed or wounded or killed. Then it's fine with me.
In November, you go to the American people and say, I'd be all right with having U.S. troops in Iraq for the next 100 years.
Most importantly, so would the American people if Americans aren't dying. We have a base in the neighboring country of Kuwait, a very large base. We have a base in Turkey. We have bases in Japan, Germany. We've had bases there. It's not American presence that bothers the American people. It's American casualties. And if Americans are safe wherever they are in the world, the American people don't mind that. So what I believe we can achieve is a reduction in casualties to the point where the Iraqis are doing the fighting and dying. We're supporting them, and over time, then it'll be the relation between the two countries. With Kuwait, they want us there, and they want us there for a long time, so we're glad to be there. The Saudis, they didn't want us there for various reasons, so we left. That's going to depend on relations between the United States government and the Iraqi government. My point was, everybody says, how long are we going to stay? My point is, when are we going to succeed, which we are succeeding now, so that the Iraqi government is functioning and we have stability in the region, instability in Iraq.
What kind of troop levels for the next 10, 20 years?
That's very hard to say, but the troops would be out of harm's way. That's the key to it.
Would you have permanent bases?
If that seems to be necessary in some respects, it depends on the threat. I mean, look, what if Jordan falls? What if there's another war with Israel? What if Egypt, that there's tremendous upheaval? This is a very unstable part of the world, as we just found out in Pakistan. So it depends on our national security threats and the needs to meet them. But right now, I just want to look you in the eye and tell you that Al-Qaeda is on the run and they're not defeated. But we are succeeding, and many, many experts said that the surge would not succeed and said that I was wrong. And my friend, I was right.
Looking back at the beginning of the war, back in March of 2003, yeah. If you had known then, if the intelligence came out and said, we know that Saddam Hussein does not have biological or chemical or a nuclear program, would you still have voted to authorize the war?
Well, obviously, given information that we have, changes your decision-making process. But Saddam Hussein was still a threat. The sanctions were breaking down. There was a multi-billion dollar oil for food scandal in the United Nations. Every day, American airplanes were being shot at. Saddam Hussein had used and acquired weapons of mass destruction in the past, and there was no doubt there was going to be in the future. The problem in Iraq, my friend, was not whether we went in or not. It's the way it was mishandled after the initial invasion.
But, Senator, it's an important question because President Bush has said, yeah. Even if I knew he did not have biological, chemical, or nuclear program, I still would go into Iraq to topple Saddam Hussein. Would you have?
Yes, but the point is that if we had done it right, it's been well chronicled in many books, you and I wouldn't be even discussing that now, the mishandling after the war. Look, I met with a high-ranking former Al-Qaeda operative in Iraq recently, and I asked him, how did you succeed? He said, the lawlessness after the initial invasion and Abu Ghraib. And so they were able to recruit people because of the disorder and the mishandling. So you would not be asking me if it had been mishandled. You would have said, if because we succeeded and established a stable Iraq, you'd have said, aren't you glad we went in? Because Saddam Hussein, one of the most brutal, most terrible dictators in history, who fought in several wars, used weapons of mass destruction, invaded his neighbor, is now gone from the world scene. That's what you'd be saying.
But I think there'd be a real debate amongst the American people if we were told he did not have biological, chemical, nuclear.
If frogs had wings. Look, Tim, we can talk about lots of hypotheticals. Would we have stopped Saddam Hussein from going into Kuwait back in 91 when he went in? Would we have said that the Chinese aren't going to cross? Would we have known, if we had known that the Chinese were going to cross the Yalu in the Korean War, would we have done it differently? I'd love to get into thousands of historical hypotheticals with us. But what we knew at the time and the information we had at the time, that every single single intelligence agency in the world believed he had weapons of mass destruction.
The bottom line, the war.
Well, now that's just a flat out lie. When Mr. McCain says that, that is a flat out lie that every single intelligence agency in the world and all the experts they would have you believe thought that there was a pile of WMDs sitting there ready to have their fuses lit, and that is simply not the case. We remember Muhammad al-Baradei. We remember Scott Ritter. We remember many experts that were there on the ground actually doing inspections, carrying out inspections for the UN and other organizations that advised against this because they felt that there were no WMDs that were a threat. Saddam Hussein was not a threat to the United States. I know that the Bush administration has done yeoman's duty trying to convince the world of that, trying to convince the American people that. Did a good job of convincing the American people. You remember your story about the drones and all that were flying overhead and all that. It's one of the great lies in history that's been pulled off against the people of a nation. They did it. They got away with it. And many people are reaping the rewards of it. And some people are reaping something else. Death for 4,000 American military personnel. Over 20,000 injured. God only knows how many innocent Iraqis killed. But the military-industrial complex has come out just fine. Read a terrible story today about some idiot that got a government contract selling inferior ammunition to the Iraqis and the Afghanis. Well, it's an ugly situation. We're going to pause a little extra early today for the news. We've got a guest scheduled coming up around the top of the hour, so we're going to pause for news early. And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes, so don't go away.
In Iraq Wednesday, 76 Iraqis were killed and 367 wounded. One British and two American soldiers were also killed. 60 gunmen were killed as U.S. choppers fired rockets in central Hilla. A U.S. airstrike killed five Iraqi civilians, including a judge, in the town of Tikrit. In Basra, the Mahdi army arrested 17 American soldiers and seized seven Hummer military vehicles. 250 Iraqi soldiers surrendered to the Mahdi army. 50,000 Iraqi troops and coalition jet fighters are attacking Shiite militias in the oil-rich city of Basra. U.S. forces have surrounded Baghdad's Sadr city, and fighting is reported in the cities of Kut, Diwaniya, Karbala, and Hilla. Britain's powerful teachers' union vowed Wednesday to stop military recruitment campaigns in schools that promote pro-war propaganda. The National Union of Teachers voted to back staff who resist armed forces publicity drives and urged Education for Peace to be embedded in the curriculum. Delegates at the union's annual conference backed a motion committing the NUT to support teachers and schools in opposing Ministry of Defence recruitment activities that are based on misleading propaganda. Delegate Paul McGar said, "I find it difficult to imagine any recruitment material that is not misleading. We would have material saying, 'Join the army and we will send you to bomb, shoot, and possibly torture fellow human beings in other countries. Join the army and be sent into situations where people try and shoot you and kill you because you are occupying their countries.'" 2 weeks after signing a landmark peace accord, Chad and Sudan have accused each other of supporting fresh attacks into their respective territories, Sudan's UN envoy Abdel Mahmoud Abdel Hamid said, Chad has facilitated the entry of rebels to carry out sabotage acts in Sudan's Darfur region. Chad's foreign minister, Ahmad Alami, formally denied the accusations, but said he had irrefutable proof of the intentions of Sudan to attack. Chadian President Idriss Deby and Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir signed a peace agreement on 13th of March at the Organization of the Islamic Conference Summit in Dakar, Senegal. The aim of the accord was to put an end once and for all to disputes between the two countries and re-establish peace in the sub-region. An estimated 400,000 people have been killed and 2.7 million displaced as the result of fighting in Darfur and eastern Chad.
This is the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Tune in to Fox Stop this Thursday midnight for part three of Lenin on Lenin, Blame It on Bermuda. This week, we'll listen in on the creative process of starting over and I'm losing you.
I've had tongue-in-cheek all along. I'm the walrus. All of them had tongue-in-cheek. Just because other people see depths of whatever in it, what does it really mean? I am the Eggman, you know. It could have been the pudding basin for all I care. Just tongue-in-cheek.
So be there this Thursday, midnight Eastern on Fox Stop. Right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn. This is Billy Shears, and hey, thanks for lending an ear.
The Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life, you hear me? Give my creation life.
So this was fun.
You're gonna like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Good countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast.
Your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. And let's get right to it. As promised, I have with me co-author of the new book, Free Ride. I have Paul Waldman, who wrote this new book along with David Brock. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I really, really enjoyed this book. I had a chance to read it in the last couple of days, and it's a good one. It ought to be required reading for everybody going to the polls this year.
Well, we hope so.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? That'd be guaranteed, what, 100 million copies or something like that.
That would be something.
That wouldn't be bad at all.
The purpose-driven life.
Yes, yes. it's a really good read, and it exposes a lot about John Sidney McCain that the public doesn't know. And the whole premise of the book is the reason the public doesn't know is because It seems that John McCain has this very special relationship with the media. How did you find out about that? That's not a good question. How did you find out about that? But what caused you to go into that?
Well, as you said, I think what you said implies that it's obvious to most people who pay attention to the news. And we thought that there are a few more important media stories in the last decade, at least, than the relationship between John McCain and the press. And it's become more important now that he is going to be the Republican nominee for president. Simply put, there's no politician in America in decades who has had as good a relationship with the national media as John McCain has. They have been telling a story about him that basically makes him all virtue and no vice for a long time now. And the problem is that all too often what it means is that we're not getting the full story. It's not just about him getting good coverage. It's about what gets left out, what gets ignored, what gets glossed over. And McCain is a politician like any other, and he has a politician's strengths and a politician's failings. But if you read his coverage, what it would seem like is that he's not a politician. He's different from every other politician. He's kind of a heroic figure waging lonely and noble crusades, and he's different from every other person who is engaged in his profession. But that's not where the facts are, and our hope is that reporters will kind of take a step back, hopefully with our encouragement, and look at what they've been saying about McCain and ask whether or not it's really true, and see if he should be reevaluated with judging him by the same standards as other politicians get judged by.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of the press, and I hate to use the word, but particularly the Washington press, just fawns over the guy.
They absolutely do, and they have this image of him that they've been pushing, that we refer to it as the myth of McCain. And some pieces of it are just false, and some pieces of it have some basis in truth but have been wildly exaggerated. And it includes things like the idea that he's a maverick, that he's an ideological moderate, that he doesn't do things because of a political expediency, that he acts only on principle and never out of political motivations. These are the kind of things we've been hearing over and over and over about John McCain. And what it results in is kind of a skewed picture. Let me give you an example. One of the things that the press has been telling us for a long time is that John McCain is the enemy of the special interests, that he's the reformer, he's the one who stands up to the lobbyists and to the people who are trying to peddle influence in Washington. He's the one who's pure when everything around him is corrupt. That's the story we've been told. But if you go to our website, McCainsFreeRide.com, you can see there we have a very big chart that details all of the different lobbyists who are working for John McCain. Now, just to rattle off a few of them, his campaign manager is a corporate lobbyist. His deputy campaign manager is a corporate lobbyist. His chief political advisor is a corporate lobbyist. His chief fundraiser is a corporate lobbyist. His campaign co-chair is a corporate lobbyist. I could keep going on and on. Now, what would happen is for a different candidate, if that were the structure of their campaign, the press would say, okay, well, what does this tell us about him? Is he too tied to the special interest? Who do those lobbyists represent? Are those people going to get special favors? Let's investigate this and ask what it tells us about this candidate. That's what they would do if it was somebody else. But because it's John McCain, they've already decided that he's the enemy of the special interests, so they don't investigate the connections that he has with lobbyists because it just doesn't accord with the picture that they've been painting for so long.
Why do you think this has all come about? Is it because of his war record that nobody's they're not afraid to touch him, or is it in fact he's one of the boys there in Washington?
There are a number of different factors, but none is more important than the personal relationships that he's built with the press. Now, the important thing to understand about this is that it didn't just happen. It's not just a product of his personality. It was a strategy. John McCain has a more nuanced understanding of the media than any other politician in Washington today. And what he figured out was that the normal relationship the politicians have with reporters was serving them badly. That the normal relationship is one that's very tense. You know, the politician is always worried that he's going to make some kind of a gaffe, that it's going to get him in trouble and lead to bad coverage. And so they tend to be very careful around reporters. They're guarded, they're measured, they sort of fall back on repeating their talking points, and it drives reporters nuts. They hate that. And as a consequence, they get in a kind of a vicious cycle where they're waiting for that gaffe and they're waiting to pounce. McCain realized that if he could make himself the reporter's best friend. If he would return their calls no matter when they called him, if he would never go off the record, if he would talk to them for hours and hours and treat them like he thought they were really important, then they would end up just falling in love with him. And he's an extremely charming guy. And the result would then be that he would build up this reservoir of goodwill that he could draw on. So when he does say something that might get a different politician in trouble, they gloss over it. They say, well, you know, that's just McCain. We know him. We know that he's a man of impeccable integrity, and so we're not going to make a big deal out of that. It's paid off for him again and again and again.
And he's had the good sense to know which press to treat well and which not to. I mean, his home press, the Arizona Republic in Phoenix and so forth, he doesn't have a good relationship with them at all, does he?
No, this is a very interesting part of the story. It would surprise most people who have seen the way he gets covered in the national media to know that John McCain's relationship with his home state media is extremely contentious. And what you get if you live in Arizona and you read the paper and you watch TV is a very different picture of John McCain. It's a kind of warts and all picture. They talk about his good qualities, but also some of his not so admirable qualities, like the fact that he has a volcanic temper and can be kind of vindictive and has left a trail of people whom he's insulted. Pledged that he's going to ruin their careers and things like that across Arizona. And the result of that more complete coverage is that McCain does not get along well with the Arizona media. In 2000, he wouldn't let the Arizona Republic reporter, the reporter for the biggest newspaper in his home state, have a seat on the Straight Talk Express. So it tells you that he's been treated very differently there, and he treats them very differently. And it's not the same kind of love affair that he's had with the national media.
And yet the Arizona Republic even backed him early on in his career in several of his campaigns.
They have, and they've endorsed him a number of times. And if you read their editorials about him and their news coverage, they say, you know, we've endorsed him in the past, but we think that this thing that he's doing now is wrong, or that this characteristic of his is a problem. And that has made McCain extremely displeased, because the coverage that he's gotten used to is coverage that glosses over his faults and focuses on his good points. I mean, the way we put it is that if every politician was covered the way John McCain is covered, they would be defined by the most noble thing they had ever done, not by the worst thing they had ever done, which is the way the typical politician gets defined. And the focus would all be on their best qualities and not on their worst qualities. And when you think about it in those terms, you realize that the image of McCain is in many ways kind of the mirror image of the ordinary politician. And they often say that explicitly, that McCain is the anti-politician. He's not like all the rest. They're bad, in essence, and he's good.
Well, certainly not. He's not like the rest. And I know a lot of people on Capitol Hill, and I know you do as well. And when you walk down through the halls of the Capitol and the Senate office building, you can talk to a goodly number of staff, and you can talk to some of his fellow senators that really, I mean, let's be honest here, that hate his guts. He's made some real enemies in the United States Senate, and yet it's not been made a big deal in the press.
No, and people in Washington will tell you that he is generally known as, you know, that some people call him Senator Hothead, because there's even been senators who say I wouldn't want him with his finger on the button, because he does have such a volatile temper. And he's had, you know, a lot of interactions, not just with other senators where he's called them names and sworn at them, but even with ordinary citizens. The question is, when we talk about character, and the reporters are obsessed with character. That's almost all that they talk about in presidential campaigns. Who are these candidates at heart? What are they really like? What is their, you know, what do their parents tell us about them? The character picture that we get of John McCain doesn't include those things. It's all about the fact that he was courageous and suffered greatly at the hands of the Vietnamese. Now, that's a part of his story, and nobody's ever disputed the facts of the story, or that he was courageous. But, you know, frankly, that was 40 years ago. And he also has 25 years in politics that should be used to judge what kind of a person he really is at heart. And too much of that record has just been ignored.
Well, it's amazing, just from the last campaign till this one, John Kerry gets crucified by the Swift Boat veterans for his service, and John McCain is something you really can't touch in this campaign, nor should you. I'm not saying you should. He's earned his accolades as a true American hero, but getting back to his views on the war and all, he is, you've got a section of your book called A Hawk's Hawk, and without question, I don't think the man's seen a war he didn't like.
No, and that's, you know, today he gave a speech, or maybe it was yesterday, about foreign policy, where he talked about how much he hates war. I'm sure that he does, but what he doesn't hate is the prospect of starting further wars. Now, that's something that I think that in general of, it's true to an extent of all coverage of politics, but I think particularly when it comes to McCain, you don't see a lot of detailed discussion of, well, what are the real implications of the things that he's saying he wants to do? And when it comes to foreign and national security policy, his views are even to the right of George Bush's. He's been extraordinarily hawkish and doesn't show any evidence that he wants to change that at all. And so that is something that we ought to discuss. But all too often when you see coverage of McCain, it just falls back on those same old phrases and words. He's a maverick. He's delivering straight talk. And you don't see a lot of detailed discussion. And even when, you know, we had this incident a few days ago where he said, I think, four times that Iran was training al-Qaeda, which is false.
Yeah.
And if it had been a different candidate, the press would have said, well, this really raises questions about how much he understands about the Middle East and the different forces at work and how we should handle Iraq in the future. It really brings into question whether or not he's ready to be the president of the United States. That would have been the response had it been a different candidate. But since it was John McCain, they said, well, we just know that he is so knowledgeable on foreign affairs and has so much experience, and so he just misspoke. That was the word that got attached to it all again and again. He just misspoke. He must have just made an error. Maybe he was tired. But it couldn't possibly be that he has some kind of overly simplistic view of what's going on in the Middle East and who our enemies are. That possibility is something that doesn't even occur to reporters because they have a picture in their heads of who John McCain is, and if an event happens that doesn't line up with that picture, then they're going to dismiss it.
Well, and we just played an interview of a couple of months ago with John McCain having an interview with Tim Russert and mentioning the surge. I've been right about the surge, and Tim looked me in the eye, and I'll tell you that the surge has been a 100% success. Well, we're not seeing that right now, and yet he stands firm by his belief, and he's one that actually, well, he'll take credit for leading us into this surge.
Yeah, and to an extent he's tried to rewrite his record on the war. You know, if you listen to McCain talk, he'll say that he was always a critic of the implementation of the war and knew that it was going to be a long, hard slog. But if you go back and look at the things that he was saying in 2003, you find that that's not really true. That his rhetoric was just the same as the Bush administration's. He said we were going to be greeted as liberators. He said that the war would be over fairly quickly. He attacked people who were critical of the war. He sounded much like the representatives of the Bush administration, but that's not the story that he tells today.
Oh, and he said that he'd called for the head of Donald Rumsfeld, and he had not. He mentioned that that was the president's decision, and he wasn't going to ask for the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld. So, and he actually agreed with Rummy's plans, the original plans to go into the war with fewer people and you know, less personnel.
Yeah, and today you find almost every day some reporter will say, well, you know, John McCain was such an early critic. He called for Rumsfeld's resignation. But that's not true. He didn't. And despite the fact that many reporters have repeated that, it's just not the case. So I think that, you know, what the public has a right to expect is that every candidate should be judged by the same standard. And if Iraq, for instance, is going to be one of the key issues of this campaign, then what all the candidates do should get the same level of scrutiny. And I don't think we should expect anything less.
Well, Paul, if you ever see a time when all the candidates in Washington gets the same level of scrutiny, you be sure and let me know. It's sure not happening this year. Paul, the book's available just about everywhere, isn't it?
It is, and people can go to McCainsFreeRide.com, and they can see more information about the book, and they can buy it through there, or they can get it on Amazon, or they can get it in bookstores.
Well, it's a great read. It really is very, very interesting. Pro-McCain, against McCain, doesn't make any difference. You'll enjoy this book. Paul Waldman and, of course, the co-author David Brock, thanks a lot, Paul, for being with us today.
Thank you.
It is a good read. Lots in here that you should know about John McCain. I plan to read it again. I don't want to talk about John McCain unless I know what there is to know about him, and there's just a little bit of everything in here about his family and about him and about his war record, and it's a completely fair book. And one of the things I find most interesting in here, we're always talking about this straight talk express of John McCain's, and I particularly have a problem with that with that term, Straight Talk Express, because over and over again in his book, people have talked to him and said that, well, you've been vindictive. You've threatened people. You've threatened to bring down the wrath of the government on people, reprisals against him. And he always said, no, I didn't do that. Well, there's lots of witnesses to say that he did. Many. And there's one case in the book here. I can't find it right now. I can't remember where it's at in the book. But there's a case where one of his constituents wrote him a letter about a vote that he made in the Senate. And you wouldn't expect to get a letter back first in the first place from your senator. You can always hope. You always get that automated stuff. But he actually called this constituent up on the phone. This wasn't anybody special. She'd just written a polite but firm letter about something that he'd done, had voted on that she didn't like. And he called her up and cussed her out over the phone and then hung up on her. I mean, how many senators do that? And he's had one confrontation after another with fellow senators, almost coming to blows with some of them, swearing at them. And they said, starting out with seven-letter words, heading over to 12-letter words. So he's got a fiery temper. And frankly, I don't like to know that there's a guy with that kind of temper with his hands close to the buttons. I really don't. I don't like the idea of it. Oh, here this is. Somebody wrote a letter that challenged, when McCain challenged Anita Hill's credibility before she testified in the hearings for Supreme Court nominee, Clarence Thomas Smith claimed that her letter, this Mrs. Smith claimed that her letter, the first she had ever written to a public official, was neither rude nor impolite, and 2 weeks after sending it, she received a call from McCain, clearly PO'd by the letter. The senator ranted on and on about what nerve I had to question his integrity. He was shouting. He was mad. I was absolutely taken aback, Smith recalled. And when McCain was done berating her, he simply hung up. In another incident, McCain snapped at a woman who approached him in an Arizona coffee shop during the Clinton impeachment to tell him his vote to convict was wrong, and he said, well, I've got 4 million other constituents, and they think lying under oath and obstructing justice is okay. And they don't think lying under oath and obstructing justice is okay, McCain said none too civilly. But there are many, many, many cases in here where John McCain has, where's this one story here I was looking at? He said, the senator, oh, here we go. There may be no more frequent target of McCain's anger than reporters who fail to present him in a favorable light. This is what's so odd about him in the press. Pat Murphy, for instance, was once good friends with John McCain, but the former editor and publisher of the Arizona Republic had a falling out with the senator over a 1989 story that was critical of McCain. The senator had told Murphy that he had planted tough questions with the Senate Interior Committee chairman to ambush the testimony of Arizona Governor Ross Mulford, a Democrat in favor of the Central Arizona Project, which was a water delivery system for urban acres, and Murphy protested to McCain that the project had received bipartisan support for nearly half a century. And to that, McCain responded, I'm duty-bound to embarrass a Democrat whenever I can. And when McCain's tactics were revealed in the pages of the Arizona Republic, McCain got on the telephone with Murphy and screamed, I know you're out to get me. And Murphy responded, now, John, for Christ's sake, act like a United States senator, not a goddamn child. Murphy said that the war was declared on him from that moment on and that he and McCain never spoke again. Years later, McCain admitted the dirty trick and apologized to Mulford, who by then was no longer in office. There are many, many, many cases in this book of things just like that. But you ask John McCain, do you have a temper? Have you exploded at people? And he will deny it. So I'm not sure how straight-talking the Straight Talk Express is. Not all that much, I don't think. Not all that much. Here's a little more about John McCain.
Senator McCain, would you still have invaded Iraq if you knew there were no weapons of mass destruction?
Oh, yes. It doesn't matter if the threat is real. We're America. We kill who we feel like. You elect me, I'll start even more wars.
And you recently said you'd be fine if we stayed in Iraq
for 100 years, 1,000 years, 10,000 years. Let's foster Middle East hatred and create more terrorists.
Oh, you mean the Bush Doctrine.
It's well documented that we have, for quite a long time now, known where the real problem is in the Middle East. And, in fact, the president adequately described it as the axis of evil. I guess my question is, how many times do we have to prove that these people are blowing up people now, never mind if they get a nuclear weapon? When do we send them an airmail message to Tehran?
That old Beach Boys song, Bomberan.
Older than Ronald Reagan making you the oldest president. Do you ever worry that you might die in office or get Alzheimer's or some other disease that might affect your judgment?
Well, my children for many, many years have questioned my awareness. I don't pay attention to some of the music that they like. In fact, when I do pay attention to it, I must say that it's not—they're not my favorites. I think it was my son, one of my sons, that alleged that I'm getting to the point where I hide my own Easter eggs. But when you saw my 95-year-old mother there, I think you saw the kind of genes that I have. I work 24/7. I'm very active. I enjoy life. I am involved and engaged. And people will judge by the vigor and the enthusiasm associated with our campaign. Every campaign I've ever been in my life, I've out-campaigned all of my opponents, and I'm confident that I will. And thanks for the question, you little jerk.
Thanks for the question, you little jerk. That's how John McCain talks to people that he doesn't agree with. He's a very rude and gruff gentleman. And you want a perfect example of what Paul Waldman was talking about how this guy, how the press is in love with him? Take a listen to Tucker Carlson recently about John McCain, and you all saw this. I wish I could show you the video, but John McCain sleeping at the State of the Union address, and he was.
We begin, though, with a flashback to the State of the Union. Month, you'll remember, the president addressed the country as he does by constitutional mandate every year. Like lots of other people, I watched the speech on television. About half an hour in, I saw this.
We drove out the Syrian occupiers and chose new leaders in free elections.
Clearly sleeping.
In 2005, the people of Afghanistan defied
right
the terrorists and elected a democratic legislature. And in 2005, the Iraqi people held three national elections.
Now, from where I was sitting at the time, it looked very much like Senator John McCain had fallen asleep. There's no shame there. I myself have napped through many State of the Union addresses. But it did strike me as a pretty bold thing to do for a candidate whose age is almost certain to be an issue in the presidential election. I wrote as much in a blog for MSNBC.com. Apparently, McCain read the blog and was outraged. I received calls from two different McCain advisors, as did an executive at NBC headquarters, demanding an apology and a correction. McCain was not asleep, they said. He was reading the text of Bush's speech. Well, the days since, I have watched the tape several times, and so have my producers. My producers agree with McCain that he was reading, not napping. For myself, I'm still not sure what the tape shows. You can decide for yourself. You just saw it. But I do know McCain pretty well, having covered him extensively in 2000, and I think he's a pretty honest guy. So I'll take his word for it and acknowledge, at the least, that there was no way to know for certain whether he was actually sleeping or not, and I should have said that, and I'm sorry I didn't.
I guess don't believe your lying eyes, Tucker. And all of our lying eyes. I found that unusual, how he kowtowed to the McCain people, and that is the Washington Press Corps for you. They do not want to be left on the outside, ladies and gentlemen. Don't want to be left off the list. If you're in the Washington press corps, you don't want to get blackballed from any of these people. So you pretty much put up with whatever they throw at you. And that's what's going on with McCain right now. And they do happen to like McCain. I did mention Chris Matthews last night just fawned over McCain. There isn't any question about it. I thought it was somewhat odd, to tell you the truth. Somewhat very odd. Anyway, you're welcome to give us a call, 866-546-5254, and do pick up a copy of that book. It is available just about any place. David Brock and Paul Waldman. It's called Free Ride, John McCain and the Media, and you'll find a whole lot of really cool information in there about John McCain and something we all should know before you go out and vote. I will tell you this. If John McCain had not done another thing in his political career, and I believe I have mentioned this on the program at another time, if he had not done another thing politically, he would have been eliminated from consideration for me, for him to be president, absolutely immediately upon hearing his absolutely horrible, gross, filthy, just awful joke about Chelsea Clinton. I happen to think Chelsea Clinton is a very nice-looking young girl. She went through that adolescent phase like we all do, a little gangly and all that, but she's a very nice-looking girl. She's a very pretty girl. She's now, I think, what, maybe 28 years old? I'm not sure. But John McCain actually made a joke about her, and to give you another example of how John McCain is treated by the press. It was mentioned in the press that John had told an off-color joke. A lot of the press didn't even mention that, but even the ones that did mention it didn't print the joke, because they didn't want anybody to know how bad it was. And the joke was, if anybody thinks this is funny, why is Chelsea Clinton so ugly? It's because her father is Janet Reno. Well, that cuts several ways. It's an affront to the Clinton family. It's an affront to Chelsea Clinton. And it's an affront to Janet Reno. I happen to know Janet Reno, one of the nicest people you'll ever meet in your life. So all the way around, it was an extremely offensive, ugly comment. And knowing that anybody... And you may say, well, I'm a little thin-skinned. I'll tell you this much. Anybody said that about my daughter, he'd get knocked on his ass. I don't care who it is. And that's exactly what John McCain deserved. And what did he get out of that? Nothing. Nothing. The press hardly even reported it. And like I said, that would be enough right there to eliminate that man from any consideration to be president at all. And speaking of Chelsea, I'm sure many of you have heard this, but I wanted to put it in. I admire her greatly, and I thought, hey, thumbs up to you on this question.
I do not think that's any of your business.
Oh, I guess we got the tail end of that. A young gentleman who claimed to be a Democrat asked her a question about Monica Lewinsky, and she told him it was none of his business, and it surely wasn't. I saw him on the networks trying to explain this away. He didn't, in my opinion, explain it away very, very well, so I don't know. You're in public life, you better have some pretty thick skin, I guess. And I think the Clinton family does. And I know Barack Obama does, and I'm sure McCain does as well, although McCain's got thinner skin than the rest of them. I don't think there's any question about that. We're going to pause for a break, and we'll be back.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me. Speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me. Speaking words of wisdom, let it be.
back with you here in the Guy James Show. Join us. It's easy. 866-546-5254. Love to get your calls. Love to get your email. Snail mail as well. Do want to remind everybody that our address, our mailing address, our new mailing address, is at www.theguyjamesshow.com, and that's where you can find out how to help keep the show afloat, if you know what I mean. And we are in dire need of that right now, okay? I realize everybody's raising money, but we need so little, and we do need some assistance with it. We get letters every day, many, and I do enjoy them. And now and then I run across somebody who who's so intelligent and so insightful and sends me such well-thought-out notes that I almost think they're part of a Washington think tank, you know. And this is from my friend Stuart. And I enjoy getting Stuart's mail. Always, we don't always agree on things. But he is one of those people that always sends you something and you read it and go, maybe I hadn't thought of it that way. And I love that experience. I do love that experience. Anyway, I wanted to read you this letter I got from him today. It's great insight on McCain. Stuart says, I'm very concerned about McCain, having read Ellsberg's memoir on the Pentagon Papers and the Vietnam War. I could see how successive administrations get sucked into a problem and extend it. Ellsberg tried to stop Nixon's administration from continuing the war, even met with Kissinger. He failed, but the key was he tried to do it right at the beginning because he knew that once they start investing in the war, they own it, and then look to cover themselves. McCain already owns Iraq. And he simply believes in imperial power. Might makes right. He can't understand or doesn't care about the people there, and the economic and social impact here is irrelevant to him. And he is either refuses to see reality or he is deceiving people. I believe that he's deceiving people. The time he went to the market and said everything is fine, but didn't mention that he had 100 soldiers and several helicopters, and the market was open for him, shows me he is a deceiver and embraces propaganda. I just don't know yet that trying to attack his personality or image is the way to go. I think that a mass blitz of media on the real situation there would do him in. Reality is the most powerful force against Bush and McCain, and it is why Bush is so low in the polls. He's never recovered from Katrina. McCain, Lieberman can be stopped with a blitz of reality about the situation there. They will attack the opposing candidate personally and try to establish their own credibility and trust. And you can get away with that for a while. You can tell people the mortgage and financial market is great too for a while, but the fundamental reality remains and will emerge. I watched some of the Iraq Vet Against the War conference on the Internet that was held the weekend before you went to D.C. The testimony was powerful, and many of these guys looked like they could be the poster image for military recruiting, the kid next door. But when they spoke, it was stunning and believable. Not only of the horror of what goes on in Iraq and how the Iraqis are treated, but how the soldiers are treated here and there, and how they're propagandized and bullied. These mainstream messengers must get to mainstream America. McCain will never win then. Well, I think that is a very insightful letter from Stuart. Stuart, I thank you. Very well thought out. I think maybe you're right. He does own the war. He and Bush have claimed ownership of it. It may be a big political blunder, and we shall see. I hope the American public has the ability to see through all of that. Certainly hope so. Did you hear the news at the top of the hour talking about 250 Iraqi soldiers have surrendered to the Mahdi army. 250. And I know they have an overwhelming force. I think this was in Basra, if I have it right. They have an overwhelming force there. And some Americans were captured along with some of our armored vehicles. Yeah, this is working out very, very well. And something that made big news not long ago about Barack Obama and was not fair to him at all. And you'll remember the flap that ensued when he mentioned about doing something against Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. The United States has escalated airstrikes against Al-Qaeda fighters operating in Pakistan's tribal areas, fearing that support from Islamabad may slip away, the Washington Post reported on Thursday. U.S. officials who were not identified said Washington wants to inflict as much damage as it can to the Al-Qaeda network now because Pakistani President Musharraf may not be able to offer much help in the months ahead. Hitting Al-Qaeda targets in Pakistan is something Barack Obama said he also would do with or without Pakistan's consent. This, of course, is what John McCain, follower of Al-Qaeda to the gates of hell, said is wrong and claimed Obama is naive and counter to American policy in so advocating. Apparently, he has an understanding with hell, but not Pakistan. Well, I thought that whole business made McCain look silly once again. He may not be the military expert, folks, that a lot of people think he is. He just may not be. And now and then you see statements made by politicians that just causes you to laugh. Lindsey Graham, of course, we've got that rat pack now, Lindsey Graham and Joe Independent Lieberman. And John McCain taking a trip, nothing more than a political trip, to the Middle East on the American taxpayers. During a recent interview, Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, called Senators John McCain and Joe Lieberman something special, recounting their recent trip abroad. He also claimed that people around the world view McCain as a reassuring presence, but later admitted that no one had a McCain sticker on their desk. Graham said, and here's the part that makes you want to go out back and barf. Graham said, Senator Lieberman, I think, is a national treasure. Because no matter how you feel about his politics, he's willing to risk everything politically for a cause he believed in. But to see the interaction between these two guys and world leaders was something special. I think John McCain will be a reassuring presence to the world. It really was a smile on people's faces knowing that if this guy got to be president, I think we could do business with him. I think he's a reassuring presence. Doesn't that mean they prefer John over Obama or Senator Clinton? But there's a level of comfort here. And the question was asked, but some probably do prefer him, don't they? And Graham said, oh, I would think. But no one told us. No one had a McCain sticker on their desk. So here he comes back. First we got Bushy Boy seeing into the soul of Vladimir Putin. Saw his soul and knows everything he's thinking. And now we have Lindsey Graham, another soothsayer, a crystal ball reader, who can look into the eyes of foreign leaders and tell that they obviously want John McCain to be president. Let me tell you something. Foreign leaders aren't a bunch of third world idiots. They see CNN. They get the news. They read the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, all the newspapers around the world aren't a bunch of backwoods idiots. They know the score. And don't think for one moment that these people don't know the war hawk attitude of John McCain and would be frightened of him to be the president. Now, it depends who you are. If you're Israel, hey, bring him on. We could use another little war. We could use some more military over here, some more bases here, all that. I suppose if you're Syria and Iran and Jordan and Russia and everybody else, they say no thanks. We don't want a John McCain in this area. He's too much of a war hawk. Well, it'll be interesting to see what comes of that. I just don't believe that people from around the world, leaders from around the world, want the likes of a John McCain as the president. I don't believe that for a moment. Certainly not a majority of people. I wanted to talk a little bit about conservatism today, something we haven't talked about in a while, and I got an article from the folks over at Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, about how conservatism is dying. And they mentioned that conservatism, as we've known it since Ronald Reagan, is dying, and it's ground down in the desert of Iraq, drowned in the floods of Hurricane Katrina, and foreclosed by the housing crisis and poisoned on toys imported from China. Modern conservatism is dying. There's still an election to be held, but conservatism, as we've known it since Ronald Reagan, is failing. The American people are figuring this out, and while conservatives repeat their time-worn slogans, small government, low taxes, high security, the American people are living the consequences. The American people are figuring this out. And while conservatives repeat their time-worn slogans again and again and again, we've seen 8 years of a conservative presidency, 6 years overlapping with a conservative Congress, and 30 years of broadly conservative ideology. And now reality is showing how the values embodied in their slogans have been betrayed. You hear conservatives say, shrink government. And so what do we get? We get inadequate levies, exploding steam pipes, and schools without textbooks. And you hear conservatives say, deregulate. And now Thomas the Tank Engine is painted with toxic lead. And conservatives say, low taxes. But it primarily applies to millionaires, billionaires, and crony corporations. And what follows is a history of these problems and the direction people wanted to go instead. They do come up with these appealing slogans that always have disastrous results. Small government, low taxes, high security, that there's timeless appeal in those things. You're Grover Norquist and you drown the government to get it so small you can drown it in a bathtub. But the application of those values by today's conservatives is absolutely frightening. On shrinking government, Ronald Reagan in his first inaugural address said, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And we do have the quote from Grover Norquist, Executive Director of Americans for Tax Reform. My goal is to cut government in half in 25 years to get it down to the size where we can drown it in a bathtub. This modern conservative movement is united less by a real belief in small government, which is a traditional constitutional value, than by disdain for government. And that's what they have. They don't just want to shrink it. They want to drown it in the bathtub. And such disdain courts exactly the kind of disasters we got. We got Hurricane Katrina. Our shrunken government failed in its fundamental responsibilities when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. The crucial levees had been left to rot, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, had been systematically downgraded and all but dismantled. And the reconstruction of that great area is pretty much a forgotten promise today. And we've got a decaying infrastructure. And while government continues to shrink, America is falling apart. A highway bridge not so long ago collapsed in Minneapolis, and a steam pipe burst in Manhattan. One out of four bridges is structurally deficient or functionally obsolete. We've got commuters wasting hours in gridlock. We've got school roofs leaking and kids sharing textbooks. We've got colleges raising tuition at three times the rate of inflation as the states are cutting back on the public support. And still, we have the conservatives saying, starve the beast. But what they really starve are the triumphs of our previous generations and the investments vital to our future. We have their free market faith. Ronald Reagan once again saying the best minds are not in government. If they were, business would steal them away. Then we have Vice President Dick Cheney saying the average Halliburton hand knows more about the world than the average member of Congress. Well, Dick, you should know. Conservatives hate government, but they revere the private sector. They think the government involvement in private enterprise is bad, and that everything done for profit will be done well. And conservatives seem to forget that the purpose of profit is profit. Business interests might as well line up with the interest of government and taxpayers, but they might not. And those moments, that's when government is supposed to be on the side of the people. And that push and pull is what makes the system work. A one-sided system works for no one. And you all remember the Enron fiasco. And that was as a result of deregulation of electricity. Without government supervision, Enron artificially limited the power supply in California and drove up the prices. And the impact of the ensuing inflation of Enron stock value with no real economic basis really is best understood by Enron employees who lost their pensions, lost everything when the company went bankrupt. But Enron wasn't alone. WorldCom, Adelphia, and a host of other business debacles prove that markets need grown-up supervision. Capitalism is wonderful, but there comes a time when it needs supervision. There comes a time when it needs regulation. Capitalism left to run wild on its own without any regulation or oversight will eventually fail. We've got this housing bubble. This was failed regulation of the financial sector. That's what brought us this housing bubble. Nobody was watching the store. It became rare for banks and other mortgage issuers to hold mortgages, so they no longer cared whether the borrower could pay the mortgage. Instead, the companies made their money from the fees they charged the borrowers, and then they sold the mortgages as fast as they could into the secondary market. And these loans were packaged into mortgage-backed securities, which were in turn packaged into what they called collateralized debt obligations. And other complex assets that were sold around the world to investors, many of them had no idea what they were even buying. And this new finance structure in which those who put up the money had no knowledge of the value of the underlying asset pushed up the home values beyond the reach of ordinary buyers. And in response to that, people needing to buy homes turned increasingly to risky instruments that created artificial money to buy houses at artificially high prices until the bubble finally burst. And we're seeing the consequences of that now. And their call for lower taxes. Lower taxes, as practiced under the conservative rule, is less about minimizing the tax burden on working people than about some budget gimmickry that rewards the friends and conceals the deficits. The biggest break for the richest people. Do you know that billionaire hedge fund manager Warren Buffett ends up paying taxes at a lower rate than his receptionist? Millionaires got an average $118,000 break from the Bush tax cuts, while the average middle income households only got $740. We've been subsidizing record profits for the oil companies. And yet we have this other party talking about moral values. We've got conservative leaders that are obsessed with abortion and gay marriage and stem cell research. They use those issues to divide and confuse people. They don't care enough about the morals we learned in kindergarten. Share. Wait your turn. Treat others as you want to be treated yourself. And conservatism is entirely missing the big picture. It doesn't see the greed and the materialism that is tearing this country apart. It doesn't see poverty and economic injustice or refugees fleeing genocide. It doesn't care for the green earth that earlier generations protected, its national parks. It doesn't care about any of that. You got Terri Schiavo. Conservatives put her family through hell before honoring her husband's request. The right to choose. This high security business. Cowboy-booted conservatives constantly tell us that, oh, we're in danger, we're in danger, we're in danger, and they'll keep us safe. And then conservatives choose to invade Iraq on trumped-up charges of weapons of mass destruction. And now oil prices have skyrocketed. Baghdad has become a recruiting ground for jihadists, and we're bankrupting ourselves. And American standing has never, ever been lower in the world. I tell you that modern conservatism is dying. And rightly so. It is a death that very few people on this planet, in this country, will mourn. I know I shall not. Modern conservatism can lay dead, as far as I'm concerned, and it will. It's slowly getting there, and people are slowly realizing what it has brought us. It's brought us a mess that I don't think any of us realized was coming. Well, I want to thank you for listening to the Guy James Show once again here on the Head On Radio Network. Billy Shears, music director. Be sure and head out and get that book, Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. You'll love it, I promise you. And don't forget, you heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. See you later, gang.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I guess it's a typical day throughout the world. The fifth year anniversary of Iraq. 4,000 American men and servicewomen dead. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians dead. We're shipping nuclear fuses to Taiwan instead of batteries. Oops. A portion of Antarctica the size of Connecticut, an ice shelf, is about to fall into the ocean. Well, you know, you lose one Connecticut, another Connecticut. Pretty soon, all the ice is gone. There's a huge uprising in Tibet. Our mortgage crisis is getting worse. And the nation's focused on the Obama-Clinton race. You know, when I think about Obama and Clinton these days, it's part of it is like two kids fighting, and part of it is, as I titled today's show, Mommy, Daddy, Stop Fighting. The differences between them are minuscule, at least on policy matters. But you wouldn't note it from the angry words that go on back and forth. Obama says Clinton exaggerates her role in creating the state children's health insurance program and the Family Medical Leave Act. Clinton says Obama exaggerates his role in immigration reform and housing policy and nuclear leak legislation. Back and forth. Are they both exaggerating? Of course they're both exaggerating. That's what they do. Look, they're senators. They can't do that much on their own. It takes a group of people to do things, and so they take a bit more credit than they should. But meanwhile, as the tone gets angrier and angrier, as Hillary Clinton's, dare I say, lie, let's just say misstatement about being under sniper fire in Bosnia, her misspeaking, as that comes to the press's attention, along with still discussions of Jeremiah Wright and Obama, I just want it all to end. I want it all to end. Stop fighting. We need a nominee. And the Democrats are raising millions and millions of dollars and spending it all on fighting Clinton versus Obama. Now, those of you that have listened to me know that I had a hard time deciding between these two. I did endorse Obama. It was a tough choice. Now I think I'm even more in Obama's camp. Look, both campaigns I wish would tone it down, but at the end of the day, I think Hillary Clinton has gone a bit too far. And you could argue I'm just saying that because I'm an Obama supporter, but I'm not. I think that particularly when Hillary was saying things that McCain was better than Obama in terms of being commander-in-chief and things like that, that's just outside the line. You don't do that. One thing I have noticed, though,